This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In last week's Radio EcoShock show, Dr. Guy McPherson explained his scientific reasons why he thinks humans will become extinct before the year 2040. He outlined a combination of ecological collapse, already ongoing in the extinction of other species, a dying ocean, the prospect of abandoned or failing nuclear plants, and the overriding shift of Earth's climate. McPherson is a professor emeritus in natural science from the University of Arizona. He has collected masses of scientific papers, news articles, and statements to show the worst of all worlds is developing. Our next guest says Guy McPherson is wrong. Scott K. Johnson describes himself as a geoscience educator, hydrologist, and freelance science writer contributing at Ars Technica. His personal blog is at fractalplanet.wordpress.com. An article there has become a focal point for people questioning McPherson and the whole idea of near-term human extinction. Scott Johnson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, let's begin with this. Do you think climate change is real and presents a significant danger to humans and the natural world?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you asked me that out the gate, because I think some people who are very interested in what Guy McPherson is saying kind of assume that any criticism must be coming from people who don't believe that climate change exists or something like that. So yes, in my work as a science writer, I cover, mainly the geosciences, but especially climate science. So I'm very frequently covering, the latest studies in that field.
And are you a scientist yourself?
I'm not, no. I have an academic background in groundwater, but I moved on from that. And so I work as a science writer currently.
Okay. Now, how did you discover Guy McPherson?
So, as someone who covers climate frequently, I often have interactions with people who leave comments on stories that are usually to the effect that it's all a bunch of hooey or something like that. But on a couple of occasions, a few months ago, I had people who came in and said, oh, why aren't you telling the truth? Why are you soft-selling the problem of climate change, which was a bit of a shock to me, kind of a change of pace. And so these people were pointing me to Guy McPherson's blog, and I hadn't encountered it before, but they said, well, he says he's just passing along the science. Why do you reject that science or something like that? And I took a look at it, and when I looked around, I couldn't find any criticism of what he had written anywhere, and so I decided that I should do it. So I spent some time going through sort of his central post on his kind of evidence for his claims, and I tried to break down sort of the problems that I found there.
Why do you compare Guy McPherson to a climate skeptic? He obviously believes climate change is real.
Right, yeah, and it's not a position comparison that I've made, it's a stylistic one. Many of the things that climate skeptics do to make the arguments that they make is to kind of take things out of context, not assess a whole field, but, just look at one paper or something like that, to accuse climate scientists of some kind of bias or fraud or lying. And some of these same things kind of surprisingly show up in what Guy wrote. So that was something that sort of struck me, that I saw the same sorts of rhetorical dodges, if you want to put it that way.
Well, last week I asked Guy why he says we will go extinct so soon in the 2030s. He cited work by Malcolm Light and Sam Karana. I have problems with those sources. I've told him so publicly and privately. What do you think about the Arctic News blog as a credible source?
It's definitely not. It definitely is something that he's relied on quite a bit for most of his kind of more catastrophic pieces of support for his argument. The things that I've seen in that blog, which I was introduced to in, through this process, include a lot of really wild things. Like, I know recently I don't know which one of those fellows, but something about earthquakes around the Arctic, and indeed further down into, Alaska and maybe even in the Pacific Northwest. These earthquakes are being caused by the loss of ice from Greenland, and I've heard them say before that, these earthquakes in the Arctic are somehow releasing vast stores of methane from the mantle. None of these things are things that are true or even plausible. So they're really surprising things to run into. But sort of beyond that, there have been some of the things that guys refer to specifically as pieces of evidence, things like projections of temperature change with, rising methane concentrations or something like that. He points to them and he calls it analysis that shows this, but, in you know, one of these main cases, they take the average global concentration of methane roughly at present, and then they add in a single measurement from some day in the Arctic that's higher than that, which is natural because the methane is not uniform around the world. It's higher in the far northern hemisphere and lower in the southern hemisphere. So they take one sort of the highest measurement they can find from, you know, some point. And then they draw a line through those and say, see, it's increasing. And not only that, but they draw an exponential line through those things, which is not the wisest thing to do with 2 points. And so they'll draw this exponential curve and say, here's what methane's going to do, and that's going to have this effect on temperature. And Guy will cite that as if it's sort of a documented scientific finding, when really it's really sloppy.
Yeah, the only published source I found for near-term extinction other than Guy McPherson is Malcolm Light. Malcolm made a really strange prediction based on a quick release of methane from the Arctic. His so-called paper, though, Scott, is nothing more than a blog entry, in my opinion. It's never been peer-reviewed or published in a journal. Malcolm claims to know the year and even the very month when humans will become extinct in the Northern Hemisphere and a little later in the Southern Hemisphere. That kind of certainty in this complex world really sounds an alarm bell in my brain. It reminds me of the date given by religious apocalyptics like the Seventh-day Adventists. How about you? What's your take on that?
I would agree that it's definitely not a good sign. It's not the kind of thing that anyone could be confident about.
Well, I've published a blog outlining the many problems of using Malcolm Light as a source, and it includes his background and his fantastic visions like using HARP radio beams to turn atmospheric methane into diamonds. I'll put a link to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I don't want to go over it again. Now, as another poster at Arctic News, Sam Karana isn't really a normal source for science either. He or she is an unknown quantity using the name Sam Karana on the internet. He or she makes really useful graphs and charts based on data from real institutes. Sometimes I appreciate that, but we can hardly put the name Karana and a year in brackets as though it was a scientific paper. In my opinion, that's pseudoscience and misleading. Is that the kind of thing that irritated you into writing your seminal blog post about Guy McPherson?
It is, yeah. That's one of the things, because it's misleading to the reader to not understand what that source really is, you know, and what it's about. And I've seen him point to kind of strange things like that. I've seen him point to, you know, kind of off-the-cuff blog post on some survivalist forum or something like that about how oxygen levels are decreasing and so people aren't going to be able to breathe soon. And there's just no credibility to that, but it's the kind of thing that he'll end up pointing to. And I absolutely agree that, you know, it might be okay to refer to that stuff if you're going to be upfront about what it is. But I think people have really been misled by getting that message from him. They don't understand what his sources really are.
Who is Michael Tobis, and where does he fit into this debate?
Well, Michael Tobis is down at University of Texas, I believe, Austin. I'm not sure. But he blogs at Planet 3.0. And he is also the only other person I've noticed sort of say something about Guy McPherson. And I think it's because Michael Tobis is active in the Global Warming Fact of the Day Facebook group, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. And he saw some of Guy's stuff popping up there. So he wrote a blog post after mine, kind of addressing a portion of Guy's argument that I had left out. And that's Guy's list of positive feedbacks. So he sort of makes this argument, you know, again, your listeners probably know, but positive feedbacks are things that amplify themselves and lead to making larger changes than you started with. And, you know, there are many of these well-documented in the climate system. There are negative feedbacks that tone down changes too, but Guy maintains a list of some 30 or something, what he thinks are examples of positive feedbacks. And his argument basically boils down to, look at how many positive feedbacks there are, we are doomed. But there's no analysis of any kind in that. There's no accounting for the magnitude of an effect of any of those, you know, much less what they should add up to. And so Michael Tobis wrote a post where he tried to put numbers on some of those things to show that none of them, or indeed any all of them together, really add up to anything close to the doomsday picture that McPherson claims they do.
You know, there hasn't really been enough good science, in my opinion, on the combination of these feedback effects. It's something that I take from McPherson's work that it's something we need to look at. And it's true in my experience that most scientists focus on a particular climate vector. Very few are able to take on this whole complex of interrelated feedbacks. And maybe the models in science are just not that advanced yet. So I'm wondering if he isn't raising an important point here, whether each example holds water or not.
Well, I would actually disagree with that. I think, you know, it's true that some of these things we can talk about aren't currently simulated in global climate models, for example. But these climate models are very sophisticated, and their entire purpose is to add all these things together. And I think that, you know, especially when you have these tremendous efforts like the IPCC reports, a lot of work goes into trying to assess that big picture, the additive effect of all these processes. It's one of those things where I think you can have an interesting discussion of the details of some of these things and what kind of impact they might have or how it fits into our understanding, but the reality of that situation does not come anywhere close to the extent that McPherson wants to present it as coming to. So these things might not be accounted for fully. That, you know, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And you could talk about what kind of effect they would have, but they're just not going to add up to these extreme scenarios that he puts out of 4 or 8 or 20 degrees centigrade warming in a decade or two.
Right, and he doesn't put out a list of negative feedbacks, which are in fact helpful for us, the things like the ocean slowing down heating or whatever. So that sort of list should be published as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what would go into a proper analysis, right? It would be to put numbers on these things and check both sides of the column and get an actual answer instead of just sort of a qualitative, it looks bad, which I don't think is very helpful.
This is Radio EcoShock, exploring the case that humans will not go extinct this century, as suggested by Dr. Guy McPherson. My guest is Scott K. Johnson. Well, now, Scott, Guy is worried about a rapid melting of frozen methane between both land and sea called clathrates. And the principal problem with the clathrate gun and the Arctic methane emissions in particular is that some of the science put forward by Dr. Shakova and her Russian co-workers is speculative. She says there's a possibility of a sudden 50 gigaton release of methane, perhaps after an undersea landslide in a critical area or something like that. And some people, including the journalist Nafiz Ahmed, writing in the Guardian newspaper, mistook this theory as fact. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, the work that those researchers are doing up there is obviously very interesting and very useful. But this might be one of those cases where there's so much interest among certain people in their findings that it's sort of being overanalyzed and overinterpreted. And, you know, maybe some of the things that have been said haven't helped or something like that. But some people take their research to demonstrate that some catastrophic change in the methane emission from that region has already begun and is increasing, and that this is just fact when it's not. They've measured very interesting things. They've measured these plumes of bubbles of methane coming up from the seafloor in the shallow shelf off the Siberian coast. And they've been trying to quantify how much there is, where this is occurring, and that kind of thing. So many people think this sounds like it's, you know, the uncorking of the champagne bottle, and it's underway and you can't stop it. But the reality is that and I know you've had David Archer on your program to talk about this, and I think he detailed this very well, that there are a lot of complications here. We don't know how long these things have been going on. They're not necessarily new phenomena. They haven't been monitoring, you know, similar locations for a series of years to document changes. They've just found them. And so where these occur in other places, like off the coast of Svalbard, for example, research has subsequently shown that they're not a new phenomenon. At least there, many of those plumes of bubbles coming up from the seafloor have in fact been active for thousands of years, they found. And so it's very presumptuous to jump forward and say this must mean a catastrophic release is underway when we just don't know that.
Yeah, I was talking with a scientist about the East Coast where they found about 700 methane vents. But, you know, it seems like they've just mapped them. They may have been there for a long time. They're trying to measure the calcium around them to see how long they have been going off. But it's not necessarily a sign that the world is doomed. And I'm wondering, from his writings, does it seem to you that McPherson realizes the possibility of a big methane release is speculation and not accepted by some other scientists? I mean, is there sound science behind Guy McPherson's claim that the fatal clathrate gun has already fired off?
No, I think that's maybe the weakest part of his argument as he presents it. There's just not much there.
Okay. Well, now, Scott Johnson, I'm wondering on another subject, do you think there are gigantic reservoirs of methane down around the Earth's mantle just waiting to pop out if the permafrost cap above it is melted?
Yeah, I do not. That's not something that's ever been really seen. And, you know, I think that this entire idea, which comes from, is being popularized by the Arctic News blog people, is based on a single paper where a researcher sort of created methane from certain compounds under certain pressure regimes and, you know, use this to suggest that it's possible for methane to form in the mantle. It's not something that we really think is going on. That's sort of on the edge of the science there. And it wouldn't make much sense for it to kind of exist in pockets at that kind of depth. And it certainly wouldn't make sense for it to be connected by some series of conduits that's only corked by a thin layer of ice in the Arctic seafloor or something like that. So I think that's a very fantastical scenario.
Well, you raised the problem of people claiming that Earth is going to warm 10 or even 20 degrees C in the next couple of decades. In private correspondence, I asked former Clinton energy official and world-famous climate blogger Joe Rome what he thought about that kind of super climate change that Guy McPherson says is happening. Rome doesn't believe it. He points out the world is only warming at about 0.1 degrees C every 10 years, and even that's been slowed a little by ocean uptake. What are most scientists saying is going to happen as far as temperature increase over time?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you asked Joe about that. I don't think anyone would accuse Joe of being conservative in that regard, so that's a worthwhile point to make. I mean, if you go to basically the sort of culminating effort of the climate science community is to put all this stuff into the IPCC reports, right? And, I mean, what we're looking at in those reports, we've been looking at for a while, is that under a business-as-usual scenario where we don't do anything to reduce our emissions, you know, we're looking at something in the vicinity of probably 4 degrees centigrade warming by 2100. You know, going back to what you were saying about positive feedbacks before, we can argue that there are some things not accounted for in that that may bump that number up, you know, maybe a few tenths of a degree, but it's not going to double it or triple it, which would still be short of what McPherson is claiming is, you know, sort of certain for our future. So those are the numbers that we're really kind of dealing with. It's very different.
Now, those are terrible numbers, and we're in big trouble as far as the world's crops and survival and heat deaths. I mean, it's an awful situation, but it's not necessarily extinction. Now, what source does Guy McPherson use to prove humans will become extinct if the world heats to 4 degrees C above pre-industrial levels?
I actually don't see any sources for that claim. I know he's very fond of a paper published a few years ago that was sort of a physicist named Kim Garrett who did a kind of what if the economic system is like a heat engine and we throw some physics equations at it. And so he said, I think that, you know, if you're going to reduce warming, you know, by any significant amount, that bad news for kind of our concept of industrial civilization and economic growth. But apart from that, which doesn't really address the extinction issue, that's one question about economic changes, and it's, you know, one paper, and it's not what, you know, economists would say, which is shouldn't be discarded. And there's nothing else that gets you toward why he says humans would go extinct. And I think he makes some vague sort of references to, you know, maybe you'll actually be too hot to live, which seems, again, kind of out there. But there's no analysis, no published science, nothing like that, sort of addressing this very difficult to answer question of, you know, under a scenario where you have extreme warming, what would it take for humans to go extinct? I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question. It's a very squishy kind of idea. Even if you go through some sort of huge societal collapse in this kind of, you know, post-apocalyptic sort of scenario, the actual extinction of humans requires something far beyond that. I mean, what does it take for the uncontacted tribes in the Amazon to die out from these things? I mean, there are these pockets that could live. So it's a very strange sort of question to try to answer, at least a difficult one, and I don't see any real evidence that he's marshaled to do that.
You know, several of my guests have explained a basic tenet of psychology and human belief. We have a nasty tendency to begin with a conclusion and then hoover up all the facts we can find to fit our belief. That's the way our brains seem to operate. And it could be the belief that climate change is a hoax or the belief that the end of the world is coming right up. In my opinion, science is an attempt to reverse this process to have our belief follow the facts rather than leading them. In your opinion, where does Guy McPherson fit on this axis?
Well, I think you described it perfectly. That's exactly how I think about it. Yes, it is. It's a natural thing that we all do. We all get attached to our ideas. We all have our sort of cultural biases. I have them too. But I think if I can play psychologist, which is sort of dangerous, I do get the feeling that Guy had, in whatever manner, become very convinced of an idea, and that he has sort of plucked whatever pieces of information he can that support it, but ignores any pieces of information that challenge it. It's very apparent in sort of when you dig into the details behind what he's saying, and I think it does sort of explain his argument.
Well, I don't want to pile on Guy because he's been kind to me, and I've learned some things from him, and I think it's still worthwhile for people to examine his arguments for themselves. But you do point out that he's more lately got into kind of a conspiracy frame of mind. He says that Obama knows we're going to be extinct, but he's hiding it, and that other scientists who don't back him up are lying. That's kind of a worrying trend when we're looking at such a serious subject.
It is. That's always a red flag for me when we're accusing scientists of covering up information or being too cowardly to come forward with it. And, I agree. I don't want to pile on him too much. That's, I guess, sort of what I'm brought in here to do. But, I don't have any personal problem with him. I find him quite likable, in fact. But, I mean, this argument that he's pushing does have an effect on people. Through this sort of blog post that I wrote, which attracted far more attention than I ever expected it to, I've had a lot of people contact me. And, I've heard these stories of people telling me, my husband or my wife has grown despondent. They're depressed. They spend all day reading things that Guy McPherson and other people in that sort of frame of mind write. He's sort of become isolated and lost contact from the rest of us. And these are very sad stories. They're people who are literally selling everything they own and moving to a cabin in the woods because they're certain that all of humanity is going to die in a decade. I can't excuse that sort of impact you have on people. That's really negative.
It's a worry. One of Guy's friends, Michael C. Rupert, killed himself last spring, and I worry that if people are unstable or depressed and they fall into this thinking it's all over and start writing letters of goodbye to their kids, that's very destabilizing and kind of unreal. And it fits into a key archetype, I think, Scott, working through every age of the last millennia. Large numbers of people yearn for those questions and troubles of this world to be solved, hopefully before they die. And I mean, literally millions of people die disappointed that Jesus did not come back in time to end everything. And I think this dangerous tendency is starting to creep into the climate movement. Why else would 2,300 people join the near-term extinction Facebook page? It's pretty tough for science to argue when things become kind of a religion.
Yeah, and I totally understand where many of these people come from in seeing these sort of intractable-seeming environmental issues that have grown over time and are apparent inability to take action on them, and all the political garbage that goes on. It's very frustrating, and it can be very depressing. But yeah, I agree that it's sad to see people hurt like that. It's not helpful to the situation either. I mean, at a time when we should be sort of pulling together and pushing to make progress, it's not helpful to be convincing a lot of people that they should just give up.
That's a key point. If we accept Guy McPherson's message that we've already crossed the tipping point towards extinction, all that's left, he says, is to grieve and get as much joy as possible out of our last days. Well, that's always good advice, I suppose, but it demolishes any need for a climate movement, political action, investor responsibility, all that. No one knows the future with any certainty, so I think it's wrong to organize a campaign to persuade people to give up. That's one of my biggest complaints with Guy and this movement. Is it time to give up?
I would say certainly not. Certainly not.
Well, I predict that when 2030 arrives, there will be plenty of humans left in a world even more screwed up than it already is. And we can be sure of one good thing. Nobody will be denying climate change by then. But I guess when, you know, the followers of Guy McPherson will have moved on with their lives, how do you think people will look back on this sort of dark and confused time? Any guesses? I know I'm going well beyond science here, but how do you think it will look?
You know, I really don't know, obviously. But, you know, I don't want to overestimate the impact that it's had. I mean, there seems a very tight-knit community of people online who follow this kind of thing, and I think they're very deeply affected by it. But I don't think, I guess Guy's message is reaching more and more people as he, you know, gets radio appearances or things like that. But there aren't really that many people that have heard of him. And so maybe it's the case that this just kind of peters out after a while and nobody remembers.
We've been talking with Scott K. Johnson. He's a specialist in hydrology. He teaches geosciences. He writes about science. You can find his blog at fractalplanet.wordpress.com and his articles at the Ars Technica news site. Scott has bravely suggested humans are not about to go extinct anytime soon, or if we are, there is no serious science to prove it. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having the conversation.
I'm Alex Smith.